Today I'm joined by Barry Zwicker, a journalist, author, TV, and documentary producer. He was the first journalist to go on national TV anywhere in the world and deeply question the official story of the events of 9/11, which he did in January of 2002. Mr. Zwicker, thank you for joining me on the program today.
It's a pleasure.
Mr. Zwicker, can you start by telling us a little bit about your background in media and journalism?
Yes, I've been in journalism and communications all my life since the age of 17. I'll reveal the secret that I'm 73 now, and so you do the math. I can't do the math anymore. And then I worked in weekly newspapers on the Canadian prairies. I went to journalism school, worked for major dailies, including the Detroit News, and then for 8.5 years, the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Canada's national newspaper, it's called, and the largest newspaper in Canada, the Toronto Star, and then moved into radio, TV, freelancing, and I've published my own in around 1970. I became very critical of journalism as an insider. And I became a media critic and purchased a journal called Content. And for about 7.5 years, I published Content magazine. It was a journal of media criticism. And I've been doing it ever since. And this is why when 9/11 came along, I was able to see that there was a huge cover-up, perhaps quicker than a few other people, in respect of the media. Although I'm happy to say that criticism of the media isn't just the purview of media critics anymore. It's escaped into the general population, so that a huge fraction of the population now knows that they cannot depend on the mainstream media. And if I had my way, they wouldn't be able to depend also on the so-called alternative media very much for crucial information on life and death issues, especially the larger ones that involve the most powerful, the power centers of society, shall we say, what I call the invisible government, the corporations, and the people who behind the scenes pull the levers as on such things as how to start wars and when to start them and what the boundaries will be when the wars are over. So that I've grown, I think, in my own idea of what media criticism is, because I started off thinking in terms of misleading headlines and wrong uses of language. And these are all important. Stuff like that onto a larger and larger canvas, where I feel that the most important arena of media criticism, and for that matter, I think the most important arena for every citizen of the world, is to try to understand better the power structure of the world and what we can do to replace it with a much more democratic power structure.
Absolutely. I think that's important. And I think one of the things that you pointed out there that's important to pick up on is the media's use of language manipulation in order to shape our understanding of the events that are unfolding around us. And you've picked up on in some of your previous talks about a particular psychological warfare weapon, as you've termed it, the use of the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist. Could you tell us a little bit about how the media tries to shape our understanding of events using that term?
Yes, I'm so glad that we're focusing right in on that right now, because first of all, as regarding language, language quite often in the lives of most people is kind of an invisible thing. In other words, we just use language largely without thinking. And unless you've gone to university or you've studied semantics, you may not appreciate the incredible power of language. It's like Marshall McLuhan said, we don't know who invented water, but we know it wasn't a fish. because the fish would just be unaware of water because it's just so used to it. And similarly, language, each word, well, not each word, but many words actually carry powerful images with them. The word, a given word, take conspiracy, has images. If you sort of explore your mind, you'll see that the part of your brain that deals with words, say conspiracy, links up with your emotional nervous system, might give you a little feeling of fear, for instance. And it also links up with the back part of the brain where images are processed, so that you might get a little flicker of an image of three or four people bent together at the back of a room whispering to each other. And this is all in the word conspiracy. And so it's a powerful thing, and this is why those of us concerned about language and media performance are want to deconstruct such words, to stop them in their tracks, to analyze them so that we can recognize the power in them. And then by recognizing the power in them and find out, is that power legitimate or illegitimate? For instance, we use the word love. It doesn't usually cause much harm. We know there are many kinds of love. There's love of God, there's sexual love, there's brotherly, sisterly love and everything. But generally, the word love isn't too problematical. But boy, the word conspiracy is. And then if you enlarge that to examine in specifically the term conspiracy theorist, you find that it's a word, a phrase that is very, very frequently encountered. I would dare say that each person who hears this is well familiar with the phrase. And not only that, but the way that it's used 99 times out of 100 is in a very pejorative sense, a very negative sense. It is used as a put down, as in the phrase, as in the sentence. And the I'm glad this is an audio interview because the tone matters a lot. It would be, well, you're not one of those conspiracy theorists, are you? And the person practically rolls their eyes when they say that and then looks at you as if you're from Mars. Or, of course, the more muscular cousins, such as conspiracy nut and conspiracy wacko. And then synonyms that are frequently heard are, you know, a tin hat wearer, or a person with aluminum foil on their head, or a member of the Grassy Knoll Society, which refers back to the JFK assassination. Now, this is all put-down territory, and phrases like that are called thought stoppers, and they're meant to stop thought. They're meant to derail anybody questioning, for instance, the official story of how JFK was assassinated. They're meant to stop questioning of anybody who's going to question how 9/11 happened, who was behind it, and is the official story legitimate. So these are very powerful language tools. Now, they turn up in the New York Times, they turn up in novels, they turn up everywhere. I mean, if I were to collect all the examples of the use of the term conspiracy theorist, conspiracy theory, conspiracy nut, conspiracy wacko that I've encountered, I'd practically be able to fill this room with clippings and so on. And in the chapter I wrote on this subject for a book published in Italian, not so long ago, a book called Zero, which has a companion DVD, I noted that the CIA deliberately seeded this phrase into the language back in the late 60s when skepticism about the Warren Commission report was growing. The term itself goes back. I don't have the article right with me. Maybe James does, and he can actually tell me what was in my article. But I believe the word was first used in the late 1800s or something like that. and as a phrase. But if I could just say a little more about it, about deconstructing it. First of all, no one should ever accept the label conspiracy theorist as it's used 99% of the time as a put down. We should always immediately reject and confront the person who's using that phrase in that way. We should combatively not let them get away with it. We should interrupt them in mid-sentence as soon as they've used the phrase. And we should point out that conspiracy is a perfectly good word, that there are conspiracies, large and small. Literally almost every day in your local newspaper, at least in major newspapers, you can find reports of charges of conspiracy being laid against individuals, conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit fraud, and so on. Martha Stewart was convicted on conspiracy charges that do with evading income tax. It's very common, and it's a charge. That is the charge of conspiracy in the criminal code of almost every country, as far as I know. And the reason being that it's a very important crime. The crime of conspiracy is when two or more people communicate together for the purpose of committing a crime and take at least one step toward committing that crime. Now, obviously, this happens a lot. I mean, how many crimes are not planned? There may be some that are just pass-by crimes where some kid is passing by a car and just on the spur of the moment decides to smash in the window and steal the stereo. Okay, so there was no conspiracy. There was just the crime. But most important crimes like bank robberies and starting wars and so forth involve people getting together in secret and planning the crime. Bang, there's your conspiracy. So I don't need to go on more about the validity of the word conspiracy and what it represents. It's very, very important. Now then, the other word in the phrase is theory. Now, not only is there nothing wrong with holding theories, holding a theory, or looking at theories, or examining theories, or call them hypotheses, you know, or scenarios, or in the more human sense, hunches, as detectives have hunches about, you know, who killed the person whose body is lying there, but it's not only that there's nothing wrong with it, but it's that we engage in theorizing all the time, and science proceeds largely on a platform of theories being created, formed, manufactured, fabricated, if you will, just out of the heads of scientists, that could best explain a set of circumstances or a series of data or evidence. And so it's a matter of recognizing a pattern in the evidence. In the case of a murder, you know, there's a gun and there's some blood and there's a bullet casing and so on, and then the detectives find out did the victim have enemies, and it turns out the victim had three enemies, and was anyone left seen fleeing the scene, and it turns out somebody in a green coat was, and so on. And then they say, well, it looks like this number three guy who always wore a green coat and owns a gun, it looks like our theory is that he's the top suspect. This happens all the time. And in science, of course, it's even more important because scientists, in a very dispassionate way, they look at evidence and then they say, well, it looks like the best theory to explain this evidence would be theory A. And then all the scientists go back to their drawing boards and they get more evidence and so on. And when they get more evidence, then they say, no, you know what? Series A doesn't explain this fact. Theory A could not be true because just of this one fact, it just doesn't fit theory A. So, well, then they come up with theory B. This is a terrific way of proceeding. It's called the scientific method. It's the best way we know of trying to reach truth. You know, that's a big, big word, truth. And in one way, every theory remains a theory. You know, it's a theory that the Earth goes around the sun and always will. Well, maybe if we go off orbit, that theory will then have to be replaced by another one that says every 3 billion years, you know, we leave orbit. So a conspiracy theory is simply a theory that there is a conspiracy. Now, we know there are huge numbers of conspiracies, and a lot of them are top-notch conspiracies, such as the conspiracy to kill JFK. And this is why the CIA, which was involved in killing JFK, its propaganda arm came up with the idea of asking all its media assets, people who are publishers and executives of TV stations back in the late 60s, and people who were book reviewers, to begin calling people who questioned the Warren Commission findings about the lone gunman, to begin calling them conspiracy theorists. And I'll say this because James is hardly getting a chance here to ask a question, but a very interesting aspect of the term conspiracy theorist, used in a put-down way as a thought stopper, is that it protects actual conspiracists, doesn't it? I mean, you're not even supposed to think that they exist. And so it's a very, very protective device for the people who are engaged in conspiring to do really evil things. And of course they would trot that out. And anybody who buys it is actually helping them. You know, whether you know it or not, as long as you use that term conspiracy theorist, you're actually strengthening this armor, this protective device that true conspiracists are using. I'll just give one example, and then I'll stop, James, so you can throw in another thought or question or whatever. There's a marvelous playwright in Canada named Judith Thompson, and last week I happened to be listening to an interview of her on CBC Radio, on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and she was being asked about her latest play, which is very political. It has to do with Iraq. And so she was asked why she chose this subject matter for her play. And she said, well, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm not interested in conspiracy theory. I'm just interested in the facts of the Iraq war and the torture that took place there. Well, you know, Judith Thompson, bless her heart, she's wonderful. Her play is wonderful, I'm sure. I hope to see it. But by just using the term conspiracy theorist in that way, she strengthened it. She reinforced it. She endorsed it. She promoted it. You know, she used it offhandedly as if there's something wrong with being a conspiracy theorist. And so, you know, that's how, and she's a wordsmith. So this really, really ticked me off. And I don't know, maybe I'll try to find out her address and send her a nice civil letter with a note that I heard that, and asking her if she'd like to reconsider using the term even that way.
It certainly is a frustrating term, and I think the story that you just cited there points out that it is a subconscious psychological manipulation that's going on. Not only the people who have sponsored the term, like the CIA back in the 1960s, but also the people who have picked it up as part of their daily vocabulary. And I think an important thing that you've just done there is outline that there are in fact two senses of the term conspiracy theorist. One is the normative sense of describing a theory about a conspiracy, and the other is the pejorative sense, a put-down phrase. And it's our failure to differentiate those two senses of the word that I think relates to some of the problems with that word.
Yes. And, of course, the differentiation is hardly ever made, and it's understandable that it's hardly ever made, because hardly anybody ever just calmly uses the term in its normative sense as simply descriptive of a theory about a conspiracy. I guess once in a while in a cop shop, you know, in a police station, as shorthand, somebody, instead of saying, well, what's your theory about this conspiracy, to an, one detective to another. The one detective to another might say, well, what's your conspiracy theory? But you can see how seldom it would be used in the normative sense. It would be a contraction of a phrase and not one that just easily springs to mind. That's part of the brilliant malevolence of the CIA trotting it out. As a phrase, it isn't easily amenable to deconstruction. By the way, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Globe and Mail newspaper a couple of weeks ago, and in which I, again, because I was ticked off at the term conspiracy theorist, which was used this way. There is ongoing on the west coast of Canada a mystery, and that is that there's some big machine going by our house here. Sorry about the noise. It'll soon be passed.
No problem.
On the west coast of Canada, a series of severed left feet have washed ashore. I believe there have been five of them so far, and they've all been encased in running shoes. These are human left feet in running shoes have washed ashore. Well, of course, that's quite the story. And so with this report that I read, there was a sidebar to it, which began something very much like this. Everyone from conspiracy theorists to forensic scientists have joined in trying to solve the puzzle of the severed feet. Well, I mean, it's as if a forensic scientist isn't a conspiracy theorist. Of course, the thing is that there could be a conspiracy whereby people are being murdered and their left feet are being cut off in some sort of a weird signal to people who find the feet and so on. So I wanted to take the Globe and Mail writer to task for using think of the images that come to mind in that paragraph. Actually, something that I didn't think to put in the letter. But in the paragraph, everyone from conspiracy theorists to forensic scientists, ... Okay, conspiracy theorists, you think of a weird person, you know, babbling and wearing a tin hat. Forensic scientists, you think of someone in a lab coat over a microscope. Look at the difference in the imagery there. So, but anyway, the interesting thing was in that very same paper, that very same day, there was a large story about how the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had laid something like 42 conspiracy charges against people in the financial industry in Montreal. For conspiring to defraud, for conspiring to steal, and so on. You know, this is our national police force. In the same paper on the same day, and in my letter I put, I wonder if those Mounties, apparently it was a three-year investigation, and I said, I wonder if those Mounties during the 3 years of their investigation ever entertained a theory about the alleged conspiracies that they were investigating. But they never published my letter, see, because people don't want, by and large, people don't want to think about language. They don't want to really take a phrase and dissect it, really go at it. They don't want to be forensic about it, I guess.
Mr. Zwicker, tell us about Floyd Rudman.
Well, Lloyd Rudman is a Canadian psychologist who, at least when I was writing my book, because it's not that I've tried to keep track of him, but I'd love to meet him. I've never corresponded with him. He's a psychologist at the University of Tromsø in Norway. And he wrote an essay about conspiracy theory, which a friend sent to me while I was writing my book, Towers of Deception, the media cover-up of 9/11. And I was most impressed with his essay and was able to quote from it in Chapter 3 of my book, which is all devoted to the psychology of denial. And Floyd Rudman points out that in a time when people can less and less trust their government in a time when people can less and less trust their media, and we live in such a time, that people will quite naturally turn to other than the official explanations that they have been given in order to try to figure out what really happened in regard to very large and important events such as assassinations and such as 9/11 specifically. So that anybody who, for instance, comes across video of World Trade Center Building 7 suddenly collapsing into its own footprint around 5:20 p.m. on the day of 9/11, just sees that building come down kabloom. By the way, it came down in something like 6 point something seconds, which if you get out a stopwatch, you'll find that is less time than it takes a telephone to ring twice. Now, the official story is that somehow there were fires in the building and it weakened the metal, and that this caused the building to collapse. But if a building, a large steel frame building collapsed, it might fall over, especially if the fires were only on one side, and it would collapse much slower than 6 point something seconds, because there's all this thousands and thousands of tons of steel underneath the parts that are collapsing that would slow the fall. And so people naturally turn for other explanations than the official one. And people are very wise about this in their own conventional, ordinary, everyday lives. They think about who might have done it. You know, there have been a lot of whodunits. Why wouldn't you want to think about who done it? And if you're told that Osama bin Laden somehow arranged what is obviously a controlled demolition of what turns out to be a highly military building, which would involve getting his al-Qaeda agents into the building weeks beforehand to do state-of-the-art wiring of demolition charges and so on, then you realize, well, Osama probably couldn't have done that. I mean, after all, it was a building that housed the CIA and the FBI and the Secret Service and the Emergency Command Center for New York City and everything. Seems very unlikely that guys in turbans could come in and wire that place. And so people naturally begin to distrust the official story. Floyd Rudman pointed that out. I ran across, I didn't have time to properly prepare for this interview, it turned out. But I did just glance through one of my conspiracy theory files, and I found this item, which I could just read. It's very brief. It's from a magazine. Let's see, which magazine is it from? Do you know what? It's not clear. I've just clipped two pages out of a magazine, and for some reason, the name of the magazine doesn't appear on it, of course, nor the year. But it looks like it's probably the New York Times magazine from the type, and I subscribe to the New York Times. And this little item, it's just like a little goofy item, as it were. Workplace rumors are true, is the heading. And it says, so you heard from Bill, who heard from Martha in accounting, who heard from Chucky in the mailroom, that the company's plan is to downsize your division right before Christmas, and your head is on the chopping block. Stay calm, right? It's only a rumor. Well, this is partly true. It is only a rumor. On the other hand, because it is a rumor, and because it has been passed along by various colleagues, chances are very, very good that you're doomed. It turns out that rumors, or more precisely those rumors that continue to be passed along office grapevines, tend to be substantially true. And then they go on to tell that this is the conclusion of Nicholas DiFonso and Prashant Bordia, professors at the Rochester Institute of Technology and University of South Australia, respectively, who published their findings this September, I don't know which September it was, in their book, Rumor Psychology, Social and Organizational Approaches. And Floyd Rudman would love this. DiFonso defines rumors as, quote, bits of unverified information that circulate among people confronted with uncertainty, unquote. So it validates us entertaining theories that there could be a conspiracy. In the case of the office rumors, it's not so much conspiracy as rumors or a theory about secrecy. If the people in the company are planning to fire a bunch of people at Christmas, that may well not be a crime, but they are keeping it secret, and according to this little scenario. And so to have a theory that management is keeping something really important that you need to know, that's a bread and butter issue for you, if not a life and death issue, then they're keeping it secret. You have every natural inclination to theorize about that.
Absolutely. And clearly this is meant as a thought stopper. And it's ironic, you brought up earlier terms like the member of the Grassy Knoll Society as one of the variants of conspiracy theorist, when in fact poll after poll shows that well over 80% of the American public now believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was in fact not the lone assassin on that day. And then you have major scientific polls coming out now showing over 50% of the American public believe that the Bush administration had knowledge of 9/11 beforehand, and up to a third of the American public actually believe it was an inside job. And yet, these phrases like conspiracy theorist are still bandied about as if they somehow represent a tiny, marginalized section of society. And to me, it's interesting to take a look at the people who are very consciously going out of their way to use this term as a put-down. And I think you've noted in some of your work some of the academics and researchers who should know better, who are still continuing to use this term. What can you tell us about the people who are still using this term in the current day and age?
Well, this becomes very dark. And I have, in part, a theory, or you could call it a full-fledged theory. That would be up to the hearer to decide. I have a theory about why this phrase continues to be bandied about, to appear in print, and of course in broadcast, pretty well on a continuous basis, and used in its pejorative sense. And my theory is this, and I could present some evidence for it. My theory is that many of the uses are not accidental, but they are planned with malice aforethought. In other words, there's a large number of people who use the phrase accidentally, as I just talked about Judith Thompson, the playwright. She's just using it accidentally, thoughtlessly, but thereby reinforcing it and endorsing it and promoting it, which is very, very unfortunate. But then there are the people, the original people who are introducing it deliberately into the discourse, in their essays, in their columns, in their news stories, in their editorials, in their broadcasts. Now, some of these people have just picked it up and they are unthinking, and also it suits their politics to use it and promote it. But then a smaller subset are, I believe, actual agents. They're actually either they're probably part-time CIA assets. The CIA has many, many assets in the media. We know that this is one of the major tasks of the CIA is propaganda, the dirtiest kind of propaganda, by the way. They talk about white, gray, and black propaganda. Usually they use gray, which is a mixture of truth and lies, which is easier to get across than straight lies, unless you're telling great, huge straight lies called the big lie technique, which Hitler loved. Then a big lie works better than a small lie. But what works best is a mixture of lies and truth, because the truth part will connect with people who already know this is true, and they'll tend to believe the rest of the statement, which is a lie. It's called bait and switch. So bait and switch is involved to some extent, that technique, in the use of the term conspiracy theorist. But anyway, I think it's far too little appreciated that people that it cannot, in my opinion, be a coincidence. And this is where I'm theorizing, you can see. I'm saying that it cannot be explained by coincidence that the following people are using the term conspiracy theorist in the pejorative sense to put down and trash all of us who are either disbelieving the official 9/11 story, or at least questioning it. Okay, you've got Noam Chomsky, you've got his acolyte David Barsamian of alternative radio. I'm pronouncing his name correctly, by the way. I learned in Denver his name's pronounced Barsamian. You have Michael Shermer of Skeptic magazine, who writes a column for the Scientific American. You have Amy Goodman, with very few exceptions, on Democracy Now. You have the Progressive magazine. You have Zed magazine. And you have Gwyn Dyer, international columnist. You have George Monbiot, who has done marvelous work on the global warming file, although that's another whole subject we'll stay away from. And that is just a tiny partial list of prominent journalists. And these are ones who are considered left of center or small L liberal. And they appear either on so-called alternative media, and David Barsamian's specific program empire is called alternative radio, or they appear in mainstream media as Richard Gwynn's, Gwyn Dyer's. Richard Gwyn is a Canadian journalist. Gwyn Dyer appears in something like 70 newspapers around the world. Both alternative media, such as the weekly Now magazine in Toronto, one of those alternative weeklies, but he also appears in mainstream media, such as the Keene New Hampshire Sentinel. And why would all these people who are generally left-wing, generally small-L liberal, all of whom are very critical of the U.S. empire and its depredations, all of whom are critical of the Iraq war, all of whom are critical of the lies about WMDs, all of whom to one extent are critical of excess militarism, all of whom are critical to one extent or another of crony capitalism, of monopoly capitalism, the depredations of the worst of the corporate side of things, and so on. Could go all down the line, all of whom are critical of U.S. foreign policy to one extent or another. Why suddenly, on the subject of 9/11, when the evidence is right before our eyes that World Trade Center Building 7 couldn't have been done by bin Laden and much other evidence, why would they suddenly depart from their usual pattern and not only refuse to look at any of the questions surrounding 9/11, but also go out of their way to tarnish and trash those of us who do, and who, as you point out, James, now constitute 30 or so percent of the population in most countries? Why would they do that? Is that coincidence? I would suggest no, that a reasonable theory would be not that it's coincidence, but rather that it's deliberate. If it's deliberate, and they've all done this, they tend to do this on an ongoing basis, but especially there was a spate of claims of wacko and conspiracy nut around the time of the fifth anniversary of 9/11. Is that a coincidence also? I should suggest not. The CIA knows a lot about psychology, and its psychological warfare branch has always been, well, at one point was claimed it was the largest branch, and I'm sure it was, and maybe still is, but probably it varies from time to time depending on what other nefarious business the CIA is going about, such as training Mujahideen in Afghanistan to the tune of $9 billion. That may have been larger budget than the psychological warfare budget the years they were doing that. But anyway, is it just a coincidence? No. The CIA knows about psychology. Yes. The CIA knows this about anniversaries. I referred back to the fifth anniversary of 9/11. It was a U.S. Social critic, I forget his name, who said this: anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power. You know, a wedding anniversary, a birthday in your own personal life, these are times to stop and reflect when we're in a more receptive mood, or maybe a celebratory mood, but we're in a special mood. It's a special time. Similarly, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. I mean, that's just in the American experience. This is just a very powerful, emotional time, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And so it goes. So therefore, on the fifth anniversary of 9/11, the CIA would know that people are in a reflective mood, certainly not celebratory, and their old emotions that were triggered at the time of 9/11, the emotions of fear, grief, revenge, tragedy, whatever, very powerful emotions, would be revisited on the anniversary. And that's when they trotted out in Gwynne Dyer's column and in other columns. There was suddenly a spate of columnists writing about conspiracy theories. Gwynne Dyer wrote about the wonderful DVD Loose Change at that time, which had to be a threat to the invisible government because it had something like 10 million downloads by that time. And Gwynne Dyer wrote just extreme stuff, like it sucks your brains out through your eyes. Talk about an image. And just totally disparaging. Suddenly, he was into huge name-calling, which isn't even his usual writing style, by the way. So my theory, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support it, is that there are far more actual paid agents of the CIA distributed through the media at many, many important points, at the choke points, for instance, in radio and television and newspaper newsrooms. I believe there's CIA agents, a lot of them. It's not a matter of knowing how many. It's just a matter of what are their names and how many are there. But it's hard to put a number on it, of course, when you're theorizing, when you have no access to the inside information. But I would simply put it this way, and I would put it this way pretty confidently. It's far more agents than virtually anybody can imagine. And they've had years and years, decades, to plant these people in the media. And this is, to me, one of the prime explanations why the mainstream media have never, ever questioned the official story of 9/11. When any of us who have looked at the evidence realizes it's just right in front of your eyes. So how to explain this incredible anomaly that the institution and society, the media, that has the self-mandate of examining all issues of public concern without fear or favor, totally fails when it comes to 9/11, as indeed they failed previously when it came to the JFK assassination. And, by the way, as they failed previously when it came to the Robert Kennedy assassination. And, by the way, as they failed when it came to the Martin Luther King assassination. And, by the way, as they failed when it came to the Malcolm X assassination. There is a historical pattern here. And I think that's not a theory. That's evidence. I mean, you can find evidence. You could bring it before the world court of the failure of the media on the case of all those assassinations. Which were all really coups, you know. And so it leads me to believe that the invisible government, by the way, it's just a phrase, but it certainly exists. Some people call it the deep state. Peter Dale Scott calls it the deep state. People call it the permanent committee. It can be called the shadow government, the power elite, the global power elite, the supranational society, the Russian historian Zinoviev recently called it. There's a small number of people. It could be from the hundreds to the low thousands to maybe not more than 100,000 people in the world who have far, far more power and wealth and privilege than the vast majority of humankind. And they use their power and wealth and privilege to perpetuate their power, wealth, and privilege. There's another theory, which I think there's a lot of evidence to support. It's their top goal, that is the invisible government, the global elite, is to perpetuate themselves, their class, their power, their wealth, their privilege, and that's a natural thing in nature. All species are wired to propagate themselves, including the human beings, including lemmings, including deer and alligators. And that's a natural thing. It's built into nature to perpetuate one's kind, one's own kind. And so that applies biologically, but also applies sociologically, so that these people will naturally want to perpetuate their class. They're doing really well on their private jets and their yachts with all their privileges. So who in the world would give that up? I wouldn't. And well, actually, I probably would, but I would be way, way out in left field on that. Most people would not. And whatever privileges we have, whatever wealth we have in the world, however large or great it may be, I mean, how many people are willing to say, yeah, I'd give it up for some other purpose? People would give it up for their children, yes. I mean, that's been known, where maybe a child gets cancer and the family cashes in all their life savings to get that child treated for cancer. These are the exceptions that prove the rule, that people and groups of people want to perpetuate themselves. So the power elite wants to perpetuate itself. Now, the best trick it has for maintaining power is called the false flag operation. That's what 9/11 was. It's an operation where you plan some stunning event that will absolutely mobilize your population in righteous indignation against some outsider, some designated enemy, and then you proceed to either say that that designated chosen scapegoat enemy is planning to attack you, Iran is the current example, or that it already has attacked you, as with Pearl Harbor and the Reichstag fire and 9/11 and many other cases of false flag operations all through history and continuing today. And the public has always been fooled by these false flag operations, which have horrible consequences by way of coups and wars especially. The public has always been fooled by these 100% of the time all through history. I'm writing a book about it, and you can take it from me that that's true, as far as I know. And so, it being such an effective tactic, trick, that would be one they would want to keep secret. Because when the secret is out about how false flag operations work, then the trick loses its power, doesn't it? So, of course, this is one of the crown jewel secrets, if not the top, the largest, the Hope Diamond crown jewel secret of the invisible government. And so that's why they would deploy their propaganda minions to protect that secret by attacking anyone who's showing any inclination to be getting close to that secret. And that's when they, and that's one way to out your agents, because when they go about doing that, as the Bible says, by their fruits ye shall know them.
Absolutely. Well, I think anyone with any rational capabilities or historical knowledge would be shocked to learn that the CIA didn't have a number of assets in the media. But picking up on some of your points, I think you might be relieved to know that you will no longer be called a conspiracy theorist for believing that there is a supranational elite, because recently David Rothkopf, the ex-head of Kissinger and Associates, just wrote a book called Superclass about how there is a supranational elite of about 6,000 that are actually running global geopolitics through Council on Foreign Relations and Royal Institute of International Affairs and other such bodies. So now it's all admitted. Now we can talk about it in the open, thankfully. But
well, that's wonderful. Now, can you spell his name?
Yes, Rothkopf is Rothkopf, and he's done a number of media interviews recently promoting his book Superclass.
Wonderful, because this is news to me, and I'm making a note of it. I'm going to get that book ASAP.
Absolutely. Well, I'm writing an article about that book, and I will have that up on my website in the next few days, so I'll certainly send you a link.
I'll check it, and thank you. Please send me a link.
No problem. Well, moving on, I think we've talked a lot about the ways in which this language weapon is being deployed against the public to try to shape and manipulate their opinions. But let's try to move towards a conclusion on a positive note. What do you think people should do, can do, and must do when they're confronted with this language weapon in order to turn it into a positive basis for further conversation with someone?
Well, in a way that's easy to answer, James, for two reasons. One reason is that early on, after 9/11, when I've had a few interviews on mainstream media. These again are the exceptions that prove the rule. But I've been invited on to mainstream media. I don't know how many times in the last 6 or so years. Probably, let's say 3 times a year on average. Just pulling that figure out of my head, so it's about 20 times. And I would say that probably in more than half of those occasions when I've been interviewed on radio or TV, never by a newspaper in my life so far. Maybe that's not true, but seldom. I can't think of a case right now. But anyway, probably in half of the 20 or so times I've been interviewed on by mainstream TV or radio about my views on 9/11, the interviewer has started off presumably each interviewer thinking that he or she was unique and had thought up a unique approach to the interview by saying, "You're not one of those conspiracy theorists, are you?" And it actually is funny and it's boring. And so I learned just simply through sheer experience that this was a blessing in a public interview, and so it's a blessing also, I would suggest, in personal conversation, because it immediately enabled me to question the way they were framing the whole interview. They were framing the interview by the use of that loaded phrase in a way that suggested that there are essentially two categories of people, let's say regarding 9/11, or maybe even more generally. The one category is wild-eyed people who wear tin hats and can't think straight, and the other category is reasonable people who sit back and will not entertain weird, far-out notions, because that would be an insult to their intelligence. And, of course, the phrase also was an insult to not only the intelligence but almost everything about the person against whom it's deployed, because it actually suggests, as Floyd Rudman says, that they're below par mentally, that they are lacking in mental competence. In other words, they are crazy, and sometimes that's said outright. They are insane. Now, nobody wants to be called insane, I don't think. People may jokingly among their friends say, "Oh, me and my friends, we're all crazy." But that's just said in a joking, self-labeling way. And also, it's almost a talisman against the charge laid on a serious basis that these people are clinically insane. What they mean is they're fun-loving and they do stuff that other people would raise their eyebrows at. Well, that's fine. It's like being a maverick. That's all on the positive side of the ledger. But to be called or seriously thought of or looked at as if you're truly weird and crazy, that is not a pleasant thing at all. That is one of the most below-the-belt psychological blows that can be dealt. And by using that phrase right off the top, they are in a quick brushstroke creating these two categories of people, the sane and the insane. And they're asking you, "You're not one of the insane ones, are you?" Ostensibly, people are supposed, "Oh, no, I'm not one of the insane ones. Oh, no, I don't believe in conspiracy theory," you see. Then you've fallen into the trap right there. But what I learned is that you expose the trap. You don't fall into it. And you say, "Hold it right there." That's what I say. You say, "Hold it right there. There's nothing wrong with conspiracy theory." And no one has interrupted me, by the way, when I do that. I mean, they know they're on to probably a lively interview at that point. And so then I go through what I said earlier in our conversation here, James. And then that means that you've reframed the whole conversation. And you've probably gained, if not the upper hand, at least you've gained equal status with the interviewer. You've established yourself as a thinking, sane person who should be listened to, because you have an important theory on an important subject. And so that's what I would recommend to everybody. I think I said it somewhere along the way. Don't let anyone use that phrase against you or against anybody else for a moment. Just jump right in and combat it. And it will really changed the conversation. It is a wonderful entree, actually. We should hope that people will call us conspiracy theorists.
Absolutely. It's like making lemonade out of lemons, I suppose, for political activists.
Well said.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Zwicker, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I could talk about this for hours, but in respect of your time, let's wrap it up here. I'd like to thank you for joining me on the Corbett Report today, and I would certainly like you to come back in the future, hopefully, to promote your book on false flag terrorism.
I'd love to do that, and I'm not sure when I'll be finished the book. I'll tell you, it's fascinating. It's just so important. As far as I can make out, there's been no book published so far in history just on the subject of false flag operations. There have been some books published about an individual false flag operation. Actually, an ex-Mossad agent wrote a book about himself as a false flag agent. Not operation, but agent. But it's very hard to get the information because by definition, this is, as I've said, the best kept secret of the elite. So these false flag operations are planned in extra secrecy. They're shrouded in secrecy, and then when they're carried out, they're carried out in secrecy. And then, of course, the big cover-up operation begins, and it's all done secretly. It's all conspiratorial from start to finish. It's a criminal conspiracy from start to finish, and it doesn't get into the history books because the global elite, the elite of any given society at any given time, actually goes a long way toward controlling history. What archives are there to begin with? What archives are kept? Are they distorted? Are they eliminated? Are they hidden? By definition, it's a very hard book to research, but I'm working on it. And at some point, it'll come out, and I would love to talk about it because it's hard for me, at least, to think of a subject that is much more important. There are a lot of important subjects, but to learn the secret about how we are tricked on extremely important subjects, I think everyone should agree that is important for us to learn when we're being tricked. It's very, very degrading to know that you've been tricked. I certainly know that I have been through my life tricked by these false flag operations. I accepted them on the basis of what NATO said or the U.S. government said or the British government. I'm going to try to redress that imbalance in this book.
Well, I certainly look forward to that. I agree 100% that exposing false flag terrorism is one of the most important political tasks for political activists today. So anytime you would like to come on and discuss your research into false flag terrorism, there is an open invitation for you.
Thank you very much, James.
No problem. Mr. Zwicker, I want to thank you for taking time to talk to us today and let you talk about any websites that people can go to get more information about yourself and your work.
Well, I have two websites, but I must admit they're so cobwebby, I just don't pay attention to them. That's the fact of the matter. So I can't recommend a website for myself and my work. I'd have to fall back on Google. Wikipedia, by the way, the Wikipedia entry on me, by and large, is correct, but there's a lot of inaccuracies in it, and I've been meaning to get on there and fix them up. They have some dates and names and titles and things wrong. By and large, Wikipedia, I suppose, has me nailed a bit. But what I would recommend to people is to go on 9/11 Blogger. .com, 911blogger.com, as the best site for everything about 9/11 truth. The other thing I'd say, we have to wrap up here, I know, is that I would really welcome anyone who wants to buy my book, Towers of Deception. Right now, believe it or not, my phone has stopped functioning. I take orders by phone, so it'd be not a good idea to put out my phone number right now until the phone gets back in operation. But it can be ordered, through Amazon. Also, the publisher is New Society Publishers. New Society Publishers there on the west coast of Canada. I want to encourage I want to encourage sales of my book, not so much because of the small revenue that I get from it, but because I begin the book postulating the next false flag operation, the next big one, another 9/11, as it's being called. I call it 9/12, which I fear all too much may come to pass before January of 09. And I start off the book with a future scenario about how another huge false flag operation on American soil could work. And it's not pleasant to think about, but I lay it out there. And for that reason and many others, my book has been very well reviewed, I must say. Never in the mainstream, but well reviewed by others. So Towers of Deception will include, you can learn more about my work from reading that book than from any other single source. And of course, there's that chapter 3 about the psychology of denial, and specifically refers to conspiracy theory in that chapter too.
Excellent. Well, certainly we are entering one of the most dangerous times in world history, and certainly getting books out like Towers of Deception is an important way to combat the false flag terror paradigm. Mr. Zwicker, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And likewise, James. Thanks so much. Good luck with all your work.